Hello and welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast, your source for school-based occupational therapy tips, interviews, and professional development. Now, to get the conversation started, here is your host, Jason Davies. Class is officially in session.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 68 of the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. My name is Jason. It hasn't changed. I swear it will always be Jason. And thank you so much for being here today. I'm excited to have you joining me. It has just been a great day, a great week, a great month at the OT Schoolhouse, and I am just super excited. And I know many of you have actually shared that excitement with me because you've been emailing me and letting me know. And I just love those, all of those messages of kindness, of appreciation. It has just been a great time here at the OT Schoolhouse. So I really do appreciate you taking a moment to listen today. Today, we do have on a very special guest by the name of Devin Breithart, and she is going to kind of give us all the details on what it is like to be a travel therapist. And she's also going to share with us a little bit about what she has learned throughout the last year of the pandemic and how she developed a coaching model to use during teletherapy services. Before we dive into the interview, though, I actually want to share some great news, and that is that the Back to School Conference being held in August is now officially an AOTA-approved course, good for 11 hours, meaning that you will get a certificate if you are registered and attend for 11 hours toward your recertification or your state relicensure. This is going to be an amazing conference. I cannot wait. It is 100% virtual, but it's also 100% live in the sense that everyone, the presenters, and myself included, will be presenting live for you to interact with. I cannot wait for it. Some of the amazing presenters that will be joining us for the Back to School Conference include Dr. Susan Basic, who will be talking about her RTI program, Every Moment Counts, Olivia Martinez-Hauge, who was on the podcast a few episodes ago talking about sensory and stress. We are going to continue to build off that discussion that we had and go so much further. And another presenter that I would like to highlight right now is Meg Proctor. She is from LearnPlayThrive.com, and she will be discussing strategies for kids with autism. So you do not want to miss out on these presenters and more. We have discussions on assistive technology and so much more. You can learn all about the conference at otschoolhouse.com/conference, and also be sure to register now. Early bird pricing is going to end at the end of April. The price will increase. So OT month is here. We're going to get through OT month and then the price will increase. So be sure to check it out now. Again, you can find all the details at otschoolhouse.com/conference. With that, let's go ahead and jump into our interview. We have Devin Breithart talking about what it's like to be a travel therapist and a little bit about a coaching model in the times of COVID and how she's going to now bring that forward as kids start to return back to school. So without any further ado, here is Devin Breithart. Hey, Devin, welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, and I'm excited to get to know you as well. We've been getting to know each other a little bit over social media, but I'm excited to have you here on the podcast. So today we're going to talk about travel therapy, but why don't we go ahead and start off with maybe how you became an occupational therapist? What drove you to this profession?
Yeah, so I feel like I have a different story than a lot of the other OTs I've met because I didn't actually know what OT was until I was looking at colleges. I never had any family members who received it growing up. It was just a profession that, like the rest of the world, I was blissfully unaware of until I was doing college visits. And I actually thought I wanted to be an art therapist because I really liked art. And I also really liked psychology. And I knew I wanted to do something kind of in the healthcare field. So I started looking for programs near me that offered art therapy and went on this great college visit to one, was touring the campus, enjoying myself. And then, you know, the person leading the tour was like, "Oh, what are you thinking about majoring in?" And I was like, "Oh, I heard you guys have an art therapy program." And he's like, "Well, we don't." And I was like, "Oh," he said, "but we do have an occupational therapy program." And I said, "Well, what's occupational therapy?" And then he told me, and I was like, "Oh, well, that's it. That's what I'm going to be."
That's funny.
It just made sense. Yeah.
So were you a big artist growing up then?
Bits and pieces here and there. So I won't talk too much about this because I don't want to be like too down on myself, but I was friends with a lot of really talented artists, like much more talented artists than me in high school. So I took a lot of art classes and I took a few painting classes in college too. So I wouldn't say I'm like talented. And even now I'm like, I'm not doing any art on a regular basis anymore. But it was a big part of my life for a while there.
Yeah. It's always fun hearing what OTs did before OT, because I mean, yeah, I feel like a lot of people have done some form of art. I did actually film. High school, I did all animation, and then I took some film classes, and now I have a podcast, which allows me to kind of do some of that a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's really cool. So let's go ahead and fast forward now a few years. What was OT life like the first few years after OT school?
Yeah. So as soon as I graduated, I knew I wanted to try to get into pediatrics. That was always a place that had my heart, even in OT school and even the jobs I held before I was done with OT school. So I just started applying to different pediatric outpatient clinics near where I was. And the one that I was really interested hired me like a month before I was set to like fully graduate and be done. And that was great for a while. And then after a few years of that, I started feeling a little stagnant and a little bored. And I knew I needed to make some sort of change.
Gotcha. Okay. So then what happened from there?
So I had always been kind of interested in travel therapy. You know, when you first graduate from OT school, there's always like recruiters, you know, they'll be at events or they'll like find your phone number or email address somehow and they'll call you and offer you a job in Nebraska that you really don't want, but they're very certain that you do want to hear about it. Right? So they keep calling. So it had always been kind of in the back of my mind. I moved around a lot as a kid, and grad school, like college and then grad school, was really the longest amount of time I'd spent in one city in a long time. Oh, wow. And you know, after a few years of working in the outpatient clinic and doing some early intervention, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna try travel therapy. My partner had recently gotten a remote work job, so I was like, oh, it's perfect timing. We can take this job anywhere. I'm getting a little stagnant at work. Let's do travel therapy. Let's just see what it's like. And if we completely hate it, we can always just move back.
Okay. That makes more sense now. For some reason in my head, I had just always thought that you were a travel therapist from day one, but totally makes sense. So let's go ahead and kind of start with just a general overview. What does travel therapy even look like?
Yeah, so basically you take short-term travel contracts that can be anywhere in the United States. There are some international contracts too, but those are way more complicated and a whole other can of worms with visas and that process. So mostly it's just contracts in the United States, but they'll be for different facilities that for one reason or another have trouble finding a qualified OT. So that could be just due to like the geographic location. It could be just like a really rural area. It could be because there's no OT schools around the area. Like California is such a huge state. Mm-hmm. And there's only a few OT schools for the entire state. Like out of all the states I've looked at, California has like the highest like OT to like citizen ratio of any of the states, which I think is interesting. And, you know, it just depends on the reason why they're seeking an OT and why they haven't been able to find one through traditional means. But usually it's something like that where they've tried and just due to geography or whatever other reasons, they haven't been able to find one.
Yeah. And so when you're saying short term, what is short term?
So for most travel contracts, which are, I would say, not usually in the school system, I'm a little bit of a rarity because I do just take school system contracts. But most of the time, they're these short-term medical contracts that are usually around 3 months.
3 months, so 12 weeks or so?
Yep. Kind of similar to like a level two field work, if you did 3 month field work sessions. Yeah, yeah.
So what about, I mean, are there long-term contract positions? And if so, have you ever done them or what do they look like?
Yeah. So the longer term contracts are most of what I do now. And by longer term, I still don't mean like multi-year or anything like that. It's usually like a school year length. So it'll be, you know, a 9 or a 10 month school year contract. Sometimes you can find contracts that include ESY as well. Really, you can be in the same area up to like one calendar year, like minus one day, I think, or something like that. So if you do find a district you like and you want to work for, you know, that whole year plus ESY, that's possible. It's just when you start looking into, you know, working for that district again the next year that it gets a little squirrely from the travel therapy perspective.
Gotcha. Sorry, when you were saying, you know, 1 year minus a day, it just made me think of an IEP. Like, yeah, it's right. Exactly like an IEP, right? Services start tomorrow and then it goes to one day before the next IEP is due. Yep. That's funny. So tell me then, where have you been fortunate enough to kind of go around and work?
So I was pleasantly stuck in California for a few years. California is really hard to leave. I had never been there until I moved there for travel therapy, but it had always been a place I wanted to go. I was always really interested in San Francisco in particular, and it had just been a place that I'd never gotten to travel to like on vacation or anything like that. So I took my first contract that was in Northern California, a super small town that even other Northern Californians often haven't heard of, called Kelseyville.
Okay.
Have you heard of that?
Nope.
See, there you go. And I know you're not quite in Northern California, yeah. But yeah, yeah, I would talk to people in San Francisco about it and they'd be like, oh, I've never heard of that place. But it's a really small town that's north of Napa and Sonoma. So kind of in that wine growing region.
Oh,
so
beautiful.
Very beautiful. The worst roads imaginable to like get in there because it was literally like on a mountain, but very beautiful place. Right after that, I went a little bit further south into Santa Cruz and I was there for close to a full year, actually. Maybe
that's a nice place to be.
Yeah. Beautiful area. Again, I mean, it's hard not to find beautiful areas in California. It's just a really beautiful state.
Yeah.
But
pretty lucky.
And then, yeah. And then after that, I moved a little bit more up into the Bay Area and I was in a district that was in Silicon Valley.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
So interesting. That's actually where I was when the pandemic started. So that definitely had an interesting role to play in how my services were delivered and just that kind of stuff.
Yes. And so how did you end up now in Seattle?
So after, well, I guess I should say during the pandemic, I was like, oh my gosh, am I going to keep traveling? And I get this question frequently, right? Even outside of a pandemic, we're like, oh, when are you going to stop traveling? When are you going to come home? Or when are you going to settle down? And my answer is always just like, I don't know. I guess when I get sick of it, and so far I'm not sick of it. But during the pandemic, I was like, oh, now I really need to make decisions about if I am going to keep traveling and what that looks like and where we're going to go. Because it is like, you know, especially in California, we were so locked down. We weren't doing any leisure travel. Like we were barely even leaving our houses for a long time there. So it was like, I really don't want to have to move during a pandemic and especially not move to like another state. But then it's also like my home state is Kentucky. So the other option is like driving from California to Kentucky. So nothing really sounded like a great option. But I think that's a similar experience that a lot of people had. Nothing is a good option in a pandemic. So I knew I wanted to get to Seattle eventually. And that had always been my tentative plan for the school year. And then when Seattle became like the epicenter of COVID in the United States, like in March, the first recorded cases were in Seattle. I was like, oh, maybe I don't want to go to Seattle. But you know what? I ended up here anyways. It was, you know, it's a pandemic across the whole country. So by the time I was up here, it was bad everywhere. So got to be somewhere.
Yeah. And so I actually want to use this as an example. How did you even acquire a contract while you were in California? Like, did you decide, hey, I wanted to go to Seattle, let me find a contract? Or did you say, hey, where can I find a contract? Oh, there's a contract in Seattle, let me go to Seattle. Kind of how does that work out?
So what most travelers do is they'll go through a recruiting agency, and those agencies are actually who acquire those contracts and help place travelers in them. It's not a situation of like your recruiter says, hey, you're going to Seattle and you don't have a choice about it. But it is a situation of, hey, here are the available contracts we have. Are you interested in any of them? Do you want to interview for any of them? And then if it's a good fit at the end of that interview, you can choose to go there. You can choose to sign the contract or not. So it's kind of in the middle. It's not like you're just getting assigned to a place without any input, but it's not like you can also just say, you know, I want to go to New York City and be like right in Manhattan, because that's not always an option either when there's a really desirable place that has no trouble filling OT positions.
Yeah. And so, again, kind of going off of that, you mentioned recruiters. Do you always go through a recruiter, or have you ever gone where you are your own contractor per se, or independent contractor, or having a contract directly with a district or directly with a hospital?
So I have never done just like pure independent contracting. This is something that all travelers want to know about, like either as soon as they start traveling or like after they take a few contracts, they start thinking, well, what if I didn't have this recruiter at all? Because they are, you know, to some extent, a middleman. They are taking a portion of the pay from the contract. You know, you see it and you think, oh, I could contact school districts. I could set up a contract. I could do this all on my own. And what most travelers find when they do attempt to do that stuff on their own is that it gets a lot more complicated than they had envisioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a W-2 employee. I get paid like on a W-2. I say contractor because I'm taking short-term contracts, but like in the eyes of the IRS, I am an employee of my travel agency. So that makes it a little less complicated. And when you are doing that pure independent contracting and you're having to pay all those self-employment taxes and just all the other labor that you're putting into like finding and sourcing a contract, it ends up being a wash for most people. So I've never ventured into the side of like truly, truly independent contracting for that reason. But I know a lot of people are curious about it.
Yeah. And I think there's also, when you talk about independent contractor, I know that there's also people that are independent contractors, but work through a third party. And right. So kind of they're in the same situation as you, except it's not a W-2, it's a 1099, and then they have to figure out taxes. So,
yep.
Okay. Very cool. So what do you enjoy most about travel therapy?
Like normally I'll give my answer like work-wise and then not work-wise.
Yeah, go for it.
And my not work-wise answer is not a great answer right now because it's literally the travel. I love seeing new places. I really love food. I love going to restaurants. I love just like walking around cities. Mm-hmm. I just love traveling. And so to be able to have a job that allows that travel to be like part of the job is awesome. You know, when I was working at the outpatient clinic and I had a permanent position, that was one of the things that I was like, that was a big reason why I looked to travel therapy in the first place, because, you know, I wasn't getting a ton of vacation time. And then even the vacation time I was getting, I wasn't making a ton of money. So it's not like I could do these like big pool trips very often because I just didn't have the paychecks to support it at the time. Whereas with travel therapy, the paychecks tend to be a little bit higher and, you know, you're already traveling just by virtue of taking the job in and of itself. So it was able to fulfill that for me really nicely.
Nice. Yeah, I have heard that they tend to pay a little bit more, but that is because you have to up and move your life at some points. And so I don't know, maybe that leads into some of the cons. I don't know. What are some of the cons of travel therapy? And maybe again, you want to do personal versus work.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know. I think for me, the biggest con is like, I don't know, that period of like instability where you're like not quite sure where you're going to go next, because people always ask. I get a lot of questions, can you tell? But people are always asking like, oh, where are you going to go next? Where are you going to go next? And I really don't know where I'm going to go next until like, you know, sometimes not even like a month or two beforehand. And like for some of those travelers who take like the more short-term contracts that are in like outpatient clinics or SNFs, like they don't know until like a week beforehand or a couple days beforehand. Like, you have to be okay with being flexible and being able to like think on your feet a little bit, because very often you will not know where you're going to be in a month. And that's a hard space to live in for a lot of people. So I would say that part is tricky, and it's not even for me, like being able to like not make a lot of plans because I don't know where I'm going to be where I am, but it's more that fielding those questions and like, I don't know, just like the physical act of moving is such a bear. And like, luckily for me, I'm usually only moving once a year since I am taking these full school year contracts most of the time, but it's still just like, it's a lot. And I don't even move with that much stuff. Like my partner and I share one car, we have a hatchback, and all of our stuff goes into that car. And if it doesn't fit, it does not come with us. But even that in of itself is like, it's hard to move.
Oh, I bet that's gotta be tricky. And what about your partner? Does he or she have a job that they can move around, or how does that work out?
Yeah, so he's been with me the whole time. And I said earlier, you know, he got this remote job and I was like, oh, this is perfect. Now we can go travel. And then, you know, he actually quit that remote job like a month before I started my first contract.
Naturally.
Yeah, of course. So that job ended up just really not being a great fit for him for a lot of reasons. And so we actually moved to California, sight unseen, with me like having this travel contract job and him being unemployed and not quite sure what his next steps were. Which again is like, you have to be okay with being flexible and rolling with the punches in travel therapy, because that's like situations like that just do happen. And it's hard to deal with that kind of stuff when you're across the country from friends or family or support systems. But my partner also has a history in education. So he worked as a substitute. Previously, he had been a paraeducator for a while. And so as soon as we got to California, he started working on his sub-credential there. And I will tell you, the sub-credential in California is much harder to apply for than the sub-credential in Indiana, where he was previously previously working. In Indiana, like, they will let you sub if you are a warm body and you maybe took a college class once. In California, it is like a miniature teaching license. Like, they wanted his SAT scores, his college transcripts, like all of this different stuff just to get that sub-credential. So even that was a process in and of itself when we first got there. But that's what he did for a couple of years. And now he is Now he's actually tutoring. He has a bachelor's degree in math. So when we moved to Silicon Valley, he started working at a math tutoring center. He eventually moved up a little bit in rank there. And now he is still working for that same company online, actually, because like public school, they also shifted all of their services online when the pandemic started. So when we moved to Seattle, he was actually just able to keep that same job because he's been working online since March. So.
All right. So everyone out there here, it is possible to have a partner and to be traveling.
Yep.
It is possible.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. All right. So you did mention earlier that you had, you before you started traveling, you had a full-time job for about 2 years. You were in a pediatric clinic, it sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
How do you compare the difference between not just being from a clinic to now mostly school-based, but from that travel to more permanent? What's been the biggest difference for you other than traveling, I guess?
Right. I mean, really, there were so many differences. I mean, just shifting from outpatient pediatrics to school in general, you know, I really thought I was going to be okay. And like long term, I was okay. But I was like, oh, you know, I've worked in pediatric outpatient for a few years. I've got this. I'm a great therapist. I'm going to be able to pivot to school so easily. And I don't want to say that it was impossible or incredibly hard because I got there and I did it and I was proud of the work I did in that first district. But it was still like, I mean, you know, it's just such a different setting than any other pediatric setting. There are so many laws, there are so many regulations, and it is just not something that you are prepared well for in OT school, or at least my OT school didn't spend a lot of time on the intricacies of school-based practice. So, I mean, that was the biggest change by far for me, was just the really narrowing down the differences between those two settings that I'd previously thought were like fairly similar.
Yeah. And as you and I both know, there is a big difference between outpatient and school. And we'll talk more about that mentoring and some schools in just a moment. But first, you mentioned your partner. He actually had to kind of shift in the ability to get a different type of license to be a substitute teacher or whatever in different states. Same things with OTs. Obviously, we're licensed in each state. In fact, I think Washington is even, when it comes to school-based OTs, I think they already have a credential program there.
Yes.
But talk about that process of originally being licensed in one state and then having to move that over.
So for travel therapy, you do have to get a license in each state that you're actually practicing in. So I actually maintain a few concurrent licenses. I still maintain my Kentucky license just because that is still my home base. And if I ever am like to go back and work, even if it's just PRN or something like that, I want to be able to have that license. Mm-hmm. But now I also have my California OT license and my Washington OT license. And I will say, for anyone who's listening to this, who's like, oh, I want to go to California or the West Coast, if you want to start traveling, apply for the Washington and California license now, because they are beasts. Like, I will my Kentucky OT license, I applied for like as soon as I was done with grad school, and it was so easy, and it cost me $50, and that was it. And then, of course, California's is much more expensive than that. I think once you count in like getting your passport photo and getting your live scan and getting like all these extra things done, I think it was between $200 and $300 for my initial California license. And then, of course, it was due for renewal like the very next year because of the way my birthday fell. And So much more expensive licenses and much more complicated processes on the West Coast.
Everything is more expensive here in California. Yeah. Everything. An LLC is more expensive. Yep. A license is more expensive. Gas is more expensive. Everything.
Yep.
Oh, man. You talked about Kentucky being your home. Is that because when it comes to taxes, you typically file taxes in your home state? So do you have to file taxes in multiple states if you're getting paid from multiple states, or how does that work?
Yes. And I'll say I finally broke down this year and hired an accountant. I've done my own taxes like since I was a teenager. I was always very proud of that. And now my taxes are complicated enough to where I'm like, okay, I'm not the expert on this anymore. Like, there are questions that I don't know the answer to. So you do have to file taxes in each state that you're working, as well as your home state. So for me, that's Kentucky. I'll file a Kentucky return as a resident. Last year, I'll also file a non-resident California return. And normally, I would have to file a Washington state return too as a non-resident. But Washington state actually doesn't have income tax, so they don't do state tax returns in the same way that a lot of other states do. But yeah, it's very common as a traveler, you know, especially if you're taking those more short-term contracts and maybe you're bopping around several different states in a year, to have to file, you know, the IRS, like the federal taxes, and then like three or four different state returns, just depending on where you worked.
Yeah, So this is my disclaimer. We are not tax attorneys or tax professionals. Seek out help.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I want to get to this mentorship in a second, but I'm taking advantage because you are in Washington right now. I have heard a little bit about OTs in the schools in Washington having some form of credential. I know you haven't been there long, but do you know anything about this?
Yes. So in Washington State, in addition to your OT license, which is done by the Department of Health, you have to have a credential called an ESA or Educational Services Associate to do any work in the school system. So this is basically a credential on top of any other OT schooling, licensing, anything like that that you've done that's specific to OTs in the school system.
And as a contractor, do you need that?
Yes. I think there's I think if you're not going to be practicing in the state for you can get around it. I think it's that if you are not going to be in the state for longer than a year, you can technically not apply for it and not do it. But once it hits that year mark, it's you're already late. So it's we'll give you the entire first year that you're practicing in Washington to get this credential. And then I know some travelers will probably just say, I'm only going to be there 9 months, so I'm just not going to apply for it. But then as soon as they want to take another contract there, they're already going to be due to have that credential. So I went ahead and just did mine. It's not a behemoth like the OT license is. It still kind of is. I still had to fill out an application online on very antiquated software that was what high school did you go to? And I was why is this a question now? But it was not as arduous as the OT license, or at least it didn't feel that way to me at the time.
So maybe I got more used to. It wasn't any courses that you had to take or anything like that, was it?
I did also have to take a course with it. So it was a pretty short course. And it was just 2 days over Zoom. Normally it would be in person, but since it was a pandemic, it was over Zoom. It was 2 8-hour days. And it's honestly, it's a good course to take. I would recommend people take it if they're not familiar with school-based practice, because it does go into a lot of the intricacies that OT schools don't always go into. But as someone who had already practiced in the schools, just in a different state, it was a little repetitive. I was, it was already an 8-hour Zoom call on a Saturday. So that's hard enough in itself, but it was also information that I mostly knew, but at the same time, I'm like, this is valuable information for people that aren't yet familiar with the schools.
So it'd be great it would be a great requirement for brand new school-based OTs in Washington.
Right.
That brings us to something that you and I are both very passionate about, mentorship, and probably something you and I both lacked in our first few years as practitioners. Mentorship. What about, does mentorship exist in travel therapy?
So I'll say yes and no. And short answer, no, it doesn't unless you seek it out. You'll find that a lot of travel companies will say, we offer mentors, we'll place you with a current traveler who's experienced. But then a lot of times that mentorship actually looks like someone who's on the East Coast while you're on the West Coast, and then the time zones never work out, or then they leave the company or their contract ends and they're no longer available to mentor you. And even with that mentorship, anytime you take a travel contract, unless it's explicitly stated by the facility, those places really expect you to hit the ground running. My first day of my first school-based contract, I was providing OT services. It wasn't I had a lot of time to get my feet wet. And I was also the only OT. So it wasn't, I even had this department of other more experienced school-based OTs to look to. It was, hey, this is it. You're the OT for this district. They also didn't have an OT for the entire first semester of that school year. So I owed a bunch of compensatory time that I also had to make up. So it was just kind of and I don't want to say, this district didn't put me in a bad position. They were very supportive. The actual caseload itself was pretty low, so that compensatory time was actually manageable to make up. And they really supported me as much as they could, but they weren't OTs. Yeah. So they didn't know everything, right?
Yep. So then what did you do in order to kind of compensate for that? Did you take courses? Did you seek out friends of speech therapists or PTs that could help out? What did you do?
Yeah, so I did a little bit of everything. I luckily had a really close friend of mine in grad school who had been working in the schools for several years. Basically, while I was an outpatient, she was in the schools. So I leaned on her very heavily, especially those first couple months there, just constantly calling or texting or asking questions. I also joined a lot of Facebook groups, and Facebook groups are great, and I don't want to speak badly of them because I have a Facebook group about school-based OT and I think it's really valuable. Yeah. But at the same time, I was also just spending so much of my time trying to wrap my brain around school-based OT. I was doing all the school-based OT work during my workday. And then I would find myself like at home or on my lunch break, scrolling social media, trying to do, you know, like a leisure occupation. Yeah. And then it turns into work because I like look at this question on a Facebook group and I'm like, oh, that's a good question. I should read this whole thread. And then it's 2 hours later and I'm like, well, I've learned a ton about school-based practice, but I really probably should eat something at some point today. And then courses too. You know, I got a occupationaltherapy.com mentor or a membership whenever I first started travel therapy, just because it was a lot easier to get online CEUs rather than planning where I was going to be in person. And that was helpful. So I just took all the school-based courses on there I could. I leaned heavily on my school psychs, my speech therapist. Yeah. Luckily, it was like a really small close-knit team. The director of special education, his office was actually like catty-cornered to mine, and I was able to talk to him every day, which does not happen in large districts. Yep. So I was grateful that it was a small and supportive district that like understood where I was coming from, understood I had experience with the pediatric therapy bit of it, but really needed some support with like the legalities and regulations part.
Yeah, I had no idea that you were in that same type of similar situation. I was a school employee, but I was, again, at a smaller district like what you're talking about. This the head psych was across the hallway from me. The director of special education was next door to me. I mean, next door in the very next office, not next door. But yeah, and it was just learning so much, even though they weren't OTs. I was the only occupational therapist in the district. But I learned so much about special education just from other people that had no idea really what OT was.
Right.
So yeah, great experience. So my next question on here, I totally blotched. I asked, do you think school-based OT is underemphasized in school-based OT? That's supposed to be, do you think school-based OT is underemphasized in occupational therapy school during when we get our actual credential?
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't even really start thinking about this until the last couple of years when I realized just how many therapists were in school-based practice, but it's over 20% of occupational therapists in the US that are in school-based practice. And, you know, I can't speak for every OT program across the country, obviously, but if your program was anything like mine, which it seems like a lot of people's were, you really didn't focus on school-based practice. You know, I had one big pediatrics class and we had to fit outpatient, NICU, hospital, early intervention. And then there was like, you know, a tiny little sliver where we maybe spent a week talking about IEPs and 504s and that kind of stuff. It just really wasn't, it did not prepare me adequately for what it was going to be being the only OT in a school district. We'll put it succinctly.
Yeah. And you know, a minute ago, you also referenced occupationaltherapy.com. There's others out there, MedBridge, a few others. Can you think off the top of your head one particular course, whether it be live, online, that really helped you? I know it's hard. They all blend together.
Yeah, right? I'm trying to think of a course I took in that first year that was really helpful.
And maybe it was even just a topic that you just kind of remember.
You know, I think there was one that was actually about RTI, and I'm going to mispronounce her name, but it's Jean Polachuk, maybe. I can't remember. I might be pronouncing that wrong or totally butchering it. There's a course about OTs and PTs getting involved in RTI in the schools, and that was really valuable because, you know, that was another thing that I don't even think we touched on that in my grad school program. If we did, it was long, long forgotten by the time I actually got to school-based practice. So that one was really nice because it helped me say like, oh, like this isn't just like a one-to-one treatment kind of scenario. Like you can really have more universal global support for students in the schools, which I really appreciated.
Yeah. No, I think you're spot on though. I do think that there wasn't enough time to talk about school-based OT. And I don't want to get into the whole OTD, all that good stuff right now. I know that's a hot topic, but I kind of feel like if there's going to be an OTD, it should be that real specialization. Like I should really go in and I'm going to focus on school-based OT, or I'm going to focus on PEDS outpatient or whatever it might be. That's what I think an OTD should be about. I know some schools have it like specialized a little bit like that, but I don't think that's everywhere. And so that's my two cents on the OTD. I don't know if you have any thoughts about it.
Well, I don't know. I go back and forth on it because, you know, on one hand, I'm like, yeah, OTD, like, let's get like respect for our profession. That's a, you know, an easy way. Well, I don't want to say easy because it's not easy to get a doctorate degree, but that's like a box you can check that makes it a little bit easier to say, you know, well, I'm, you know, I don't even know if I would ever introduce myself at an IEP meeting as Dr. Breitheart, but I could if I wanted to, if I wanted to pull in that authority. But then again, And I think about entry-level OTD and thinking about, you know, the students who are currently in those programs, you know, you really haven't had a lot of exposure to OT at all. You've had your level two fieldworks, hopefully, by the time you're working on your capstone project and working on like the more doctorate level courses. But at the same time, like, there's just so much you don't know and you don't know what you don't know that I think it's really hard to do something like very intensive in scholarship or even specialization when you just really haven't been working in the OT field, like hardly at all. So I go back and forth on OTDs or entry-level OTDs, at least I should say.
Yeah, I get that now because I never really thought about it from that entry level. I always kind of think it from my point of view, like I'd be going back to get the OTD. And yeah, like I know what I want to do now.
Right.
But 6 years ago, 8 years ago, I don't know what I would have been doing. Heck, I didn't even think I was going to be a school-based OT. So, right. You know, go figure. But anyways, back to travel therapy a little bit. Oftentimes, when we're not in a pandemic, we all go to these conferences, big conferences, AOTA type of conferences, and we're walking around and there are contractors everywhere. I mean, yep. They're always trying to get us with their pens, their pencils, their squish balls, whatever, you know, the swag. What would your recommendation be to a new OT or maybe someone that's just kind of thinking about going into travel therapy? What questions should they ask when they approach these contractors?
You know, honestly, I would say, and I don't want this to sound mean, but I wouldn't even engage with those booths if I was recommending someone get into travel therapy, because it is so salesy, you know, like people are at these conferences, they're only there for a short time and they are like there to sell you on signing mm-hmm. up with their travel company. And I will tell you, if you haven't already had this experience, if you give that person your phone number or your email, they will contact you for years after the fact. Like I still get calls sometimes from recruiters that I have never worked with, yep. like never worked for their company, never worked with them, don't know who they are. And they call me and they ask me about doing a hospital assignment in Iowa. And I'm like, I haven't even worked with adults in like 4 years at this point. Like you don't want me working in a hospital right now. I promise. Like you might think you do, but you really don't. So I would say if you're going into travel therapy, you know, I wouldn't really recommend connecting with recruiters at conferences like that, just because it's easy to get into a situation where someone is going to be cold calling you quite frequently. There are a lot of great resources for travel therapy online. There's a lot of great Facebook groups for that too. And especially if you have like a personal connection or even someone, you know, in your OT graduating class that went into travel therapy, ask them if they like the recruiter, if they like the agency they're working with, and try to get that personal recommendation either from someone that, you know, you are friends with, or is at least, you know, within your larger OT community, rather than just going straight to the booths with the squishy balls and the squiggly pens and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I also typically find that at the conferences, very rarely are the people that are there actually OTs or know yes. anything about.
Like, yes.
They don't even know like what contracts they have available. And so you can talk to them, but their whole purpose is just to get your name and your phone number and your email.
Yeah.
Like that's all they're there for. So yeah, no, I agree with you on that. That's true. Just grab the swag and run.
Yep. Exactly.
All right. So let's talk about this past year. Obviously we are coming around to March here shortly. And it's been almost an entire year of the pandemic. Schools shut down March 13th or so, depending on where you were. How have things changed for you?
So I'll say, I feel like I was better set up than most when the pandemic first started because I was in a district that was in Silicon Valley. And so not only did we have just a lot of access to technology, you know, most of the families around there already had a fast internet connection or they had devices at home. And if they didn't, you know, the school district was in a really easy position to provide them with it. Mm-hmm. So that was really nice. And I recognize how lucky I was like to be in that position when the pandemic first started, because I know that was not the experience of most school-based OTs across the country. Because it was in Silicon Valley, I also had like the most educated group of parents that I've ever worked with. I actually got to orient the next OT whenever I left that contract. I oriented her to all my caseload, which was nice mm-hmm. to actually have some overlap and train yeah. someone for once. Beautiful. And we would have these conversations with parents where they were talking about their kids and they were using OT language. You know, they were talking about sensory processing. They were talking about gross and fine motor skills, and they were using all the same verbiage that we would. And we would get off these calls with these parents. And I'm like, they know what they're doing. Like yep. they've, they were also, it was a high school only district. So these were parents who had kids with lifelong disabilities, who had been doing it for a while, had probably had IEPs for over 10 years at this point. So they were just really familiar with their kids, really familiar with their disability, really familiar with the special education system. And, you know, I was very lucky to be in a district that not only had that access to technology, but had this group of parents that was like really educated and really involved with their child's education too.
Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes when you're working with parents that really get it, really understand everything, you have to take a different approach because A, they know a lot. And sometimes you'll be talking to them and they're like, yeah, I already know that. I already know about proprioception. I already know about vestibular. But how did that work for you? How did you make it work? These kids who, let's be honest, they're well off and they have a great family life. Okay, I won't assume that, but it seems like they have parents that are supportive.
Right.
So how did you change from more of a in-person type of, you know, sometimes pulling a kid out to see them or even going into the classroom? What did your model turn into?
So I actually didn't have a ton of students on direct service at that district, which was another thing that made the pandemic, at least initially, an easier experience for me. But because they were high school students and because most of the students on my caseload were kids with lifelong disabilities, at that point, direct OT services weren't really indicated for a large portion of my caseload. So I had a ton of consult students. I had a ton of students that I was collaborating with their teams. But I had like a fairly small caseload of students who were still receiving direct weekly OT support. But with those families, I was like, you know, we're gonna give this teletherapy thing a try. I was the only OT in that district too. So I also had to like research like the laws on that and like how to get consent and like, you know, do you need written consent or verbal consent or like what is okay to do with teletherapy here? Lots of frantic emails to the California board that time, I'm sure. but anyways, so we tried it out. And, you know, it was nice because I already had students who had goals that were appropriate to the home setting too, because they were high schoolers and any kids that I was still working with directly really didn't have handwriting goals. They really didn't have these like kind of like entry level fine motor goals. Mm-hmm. It was all much more functional. These were all transition age students who were looking at life after high school and what that was going to be. So it was a lot of self-care skills. It was a lot of like job vocational readiness skills. I did have some students who weren't as severe, who I worked with on executive function and access to assistive technology. So it was all stuff that really lended itself pretty well to working in the completely different virtual home setting versus like working on things in a classroom. But obviously, it's still different working on self-help skills through a computer screen than it is, you know, working directly next to a person doing them. So what I really leaned into during that time was more of a parent coaching model where I did have a parent on the other end of the call. And again, I'm very fortunate. I don't want anyone listening to this to be like, well, I don't have parents who will come to their students' OT session. So I can't do this. I definitely don't want to make anyone feel like, you know, it's an imperfect time and we're all just doing the best we can is my mantra through this whole thing. But I did have, you know, adult support, whether it was the parents or another family member or even a nanny, like these kids, like, had a lot of adult support at home, which was really nice. And so I was really able to lean hard into that parent coaching model of actually like working with the parent and having, you know, them kind of be my hands and like, you know, teaching them the strategies that are things that I love teaching or things that I like love helping parents and families do. And it was kind of like a return to my outpatient days in a way, because I did have much more access to parents than I would have sessions where parents were just in the session the whole time, or even my early intervention, you know, kids where I was like in the home actually working on stuff. So it was really nice in a way, pandemic aside.
Yeah. And so what do you think about this parent coaching model is going to, well, let's stay here actually first. Do you think you're going to get more follow through because you're using a parent coaching model as opposed to trying to directly work with that student over the computer?
Absolutely. I had kids who over the spring, like I had this one mom at the end of our time together tell me, you know, I was so worried when distance learning happened. I was really just worried that my daughter wasn't going to make any progress at all. And I was honestly worried that she was going to regress and we were going to have to spend like all this time just catching her up. And with OT, I feel like she actually made progress. Like I feel like she's actually doing better than she was in the fall. And I completely agreed. And she was just one of many students that I felt that way about, where it was like, oh, you have this parent, like this person who cares so much about their kid on the other end of the call. You're training them to do these strategies that they can implement every day with the student. you know, which is what we already try to do as school-based OTs with paraprofessionals and teachers. But, you know, and not to speak badly of any of our paras or teachers, but no one's going to love your kid as much as a parent loves their kid.
Yeah.
And those parents are going to have that follow through in a way that's just not always possible to be there when a kid is just at school working with a para or a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm finding the same thing, especially, I mean, like you said earlier, not every family is in the situation to be able to do that. Not every parent can be there and give you their full attention. Completely understand that. But I have seen a lot of progress with those who were able to do that. So, yeah. Now, moving forward, as we are kind of getting to the point where some people are either back at school or heading back to school, how are you going to take that and now potentially use it in your actual physical school building? Or will you be able to?
I think so. You know, even as my district is looking at heading back into a hybrid model, which, you know, over here on the West Coast, I think we're taking things much more slowly and cautiously than a lot of other states. I know there are some school-based OTs who are working fully in person right now, but at least for my purposes, I'm going to be hybrid. I'm probably going to be doing some sort of remote therapy for a while, at least till the end of this school year, if not into the next school year. And maybe that's, let's not even think about that yet. And just enjoy the summer and pretend that it's all going to be typical once we return in the fall. I think even during providing remote therapy, you know, I do have some students now who are starting to return to school buildings and they do have a para there supporting them. So, you know, it's similar to, you know, there have been OTs offering teletherapy in schools even before the pandemic happened. That was just the way a lot of school districts, well, I won't say a lot, that was the way many school districts fulfilled their OT services. You know, again, it's those rural districts or those places that do have trouble recruiting an in-person OT. They'll contract with some sort of teletherapy agency that provides a OT for them. And so being able to have the skill of like coaching a parent or coaching an adult and being able to apply that to, you know, a paraprofessional working with a student, I think that's something that I'm still going to be really able to utilize this upcoming year. And then even beyond that, you know, I don't even want to say parent coaching, but just parent involvement. I feel like I was missing out on so many opportunities to involve parents, you know, previous to the pandemic. And now, especially seeing the progress that some of my students were able to make who really did have that family support, I was like, oh my gosh, I should have known this. Like I should have been calling parents at the beginning of the year. I should have been emailing to check in more regularly. I should have been asking for more updates at home or what they were struggling with. And it's not like I wasn't doing those things. You know, I was calling parents, but it was more centered around, hey, their annual IEP is coming up or their triennial is coming up. How's it going? So I think just in the future, I'm going to be contacting or trying at least to reach out to parents much more regularly, even when we are fully in person.
Yeah. And, you know, we hadn't planned to have this discussion we're coming near the end, but I think that parents are going to be more involved than they ever have been in education, or at least in a long time, because they have seen their kids sit in school for the last year now. They have seen what the teacher is doing in the classroom. They have seen what the OT is doing. They have seen what whatever other service is doing. And so they have a better understanding of what either A is going great or B is not going so great.
Right.
And so I think there's going to be a lot more parent involvement just because of that, if nothing else. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really hope that that can be the case because, again, like from what I've seen of families that do have the time to be involved, like it's been awesome. And it's really just like, I didn't even realize like how much I missed that parent contact from my outpatient days. That was a thing that I really enjoyed about outpatient was getting to have a parent there in the session the whole time. And I don't know, there's a lot you can do at school with teachers and paraprofessionals and speech therapists and whoever else is on the IEP team at school. But until you really have that parent involvement, it's not going to come full circle, especially as we're thinking about transition age students and after school outcomes. You really need to have that close family involvement to make long-term change in these students.
Couldn't agree more, definitely. So as we start to wrap up, I do want to ask you, if someone's listening into this and they are just blown away by the idea of being able to travel, provide therapy services all at the same time, what is your kind of 1, 2, 3 steps that they might want to start with?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would just start by researching travel therapy in general. You know, there's a lot of good resources online. I have a friend, Julia Kuhn, who runs a website and a blog and a Facebook group called The Traveling Traveler. So that's a huge group. That's a great resource if you're just kind of travel curious, but you're not quite sure yet. You're welcome to join. And she's got a lot of really good resources on just like, you know, what is travel and like how do taxes work and like how do you even get started or like what should I ask my recruiter? All those kinds of entry level questions. She's a great resource for that. And then I would start narrowing down, you know, once you get some recruiter recommendations from either your friends or maybe one of those big travel groups on Facebook, I would start narrowing down where you might want to go. Just keeping in mind that, you know, there's not always going to be a travel contract everywhere, but just have some general ideas in mind. And then once you start getting more serious about things, if you are intending to go to a place that has a very arduous licensing process, maybe go ahead and get started on that license before you actually accept the contract.
Sounds great. So we're going to wrap things up today, but I honestly just want to mention that, you know, I have a course, but for anyone out there who isn't familiar with Devin, she also has a course that it's for school-based occupational therapists. And so I want to give you a second to kind of talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't want to self-promote too much because I love this podcast and I love your course. And I know your course is a great fit for school-based OTs. And I really think that we created these courses because we both had similar experiences in the school system and really saw that lack of education and support and mentorship when we started as OTs in the school system. So my course is called the Dynamic School OT. It's a good fit for, you know, OTs who are brand new to the school system, but I've also had several more experienced OTs take the course, which I have to admit, I'll be a little transparent, always makes me like a little intimidated and a little nervous because I've had some OTs who have been working in the school system for like over 20 years or over 25 years take the course. And I'm like, oh no, like this person who is obviously so much more experienced than me, like, are they going to look at this and they, you know, oh, I know all this, or oh, this is silly or whatever. But honestly, all the feedback I've received has been so kind. And it really gets deep into going beyond kind of that one-to-one treatment and looking at RTI and looking at universal design for learning and just looking at, you know, how you can change systems within school-based practice from a more global standpoint to where it's not just you have this caseload that's unmanageable and you have 70 students that you're supposed to see each week and you are just drowning in paperwork and working off the clock. If anyone feels like that, I would love to have you in my course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I've had that same exact feeling. Like, oh my gosh, this person has like 10, 12, 15 years of experience as an OT. Like, what are they going to learn from me? I've been an OT for 8 or 9 years. But you know what? We all have something to share.
Yeah.
I mean, a brand new OT is teaching 20-year, veterans and vice versa. And we all have so much to share. I see so many of the updates that you're coming out with. You know, you're always working on new stuff. Kudos to you. I have no doubt that your course is amazing as well.
I feel the same about yours.
Thank you. I just want to give you a second then to share, if anyone wants to learn more about you, where can they go?
So I am probably most active on Instagram. That account is the Dynamic School OT. So you can look that up. I do also have a Facebook group also called the Dynamic School OT. So pretty much anywhere, any social media platform, you can find me there. I do have a website as well, but that website is actually going to be devinbrightheart.com. So my first and last name.com. And you will probably need to put that in the show notes, Jason, because
yes.
I know my names, both first and last name, are hard to spell. But I'll post blogs and just other content related to school-based OT there as well, if anyone wants to check that out.
Sounds great. And yeah, of course, all the links that we talked about will be up there, including the other, you talked about one of your friends' website, Traveling Travelers. We'll go ahead and throw that one up there as well. So be sure to check out the show notes for that. But yeah, I just want to again say thank you so much for coming on to Devin. If I can say it right, I'm sorry. thank you so much. I appreciate having you on the show today. And I just look forward to staying in touch.
Yeah, it was so great to talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
All right, everyone. That is going to wrap up episode 68 of the OT Schoolhouse podcast. I want to thank you. And I also want to thank Devin for coming on and talking about what it is to be in a travel therapy position. But not only that, but so much more. Just talking about schools, talking about how to kind of use a more coaching model within the schools. It's just great to hear from her. And one last thing, please do go ahead and check out otschoolhouse.com/conference to learn more about the back to school conference in August. Early bird pricing does end at the end of April, so be sure to check it out now. Take care and have a great OT month. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the OT Schoolhouse podcast. For more ways to help you and your students succeed right now, head on over to otschoolhouse.com. Until next time, class is dismissed.